Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Robert Margalef, whose new book, Shaping Sounds, Stevie Wonder, Devo, The Synth Revolution, and My Life Behind the Music, is out May 19th from Jawbone Press. A producer, engineer, composer, and audio expert, he has worked with a wide array of acts, including Wilson Pickett, as well as Billy Preston, Devo, and Stevie Wonder. All that, plus being part of a musical duo with his then-partner Malcolm Cecil, as the pair worked on the world's largest multi-timbral polyphonic analog synthesizer. We didn't talk much about the specifics of the book because Margalef relates that all in pretty clear prose. Instead, we discussed his attitudes towards AI, musical communities, and what the future might hold for him in the world of music making. That's Robert Margalef on Into Music, coming up now. I wanted to start by just kind of asking an obvious question about the book, which is, what made it the right time to put this all down?
Well, people would always say with me, hey, kid, you know, you got a lot going for you. Why don't you sit down and write a book? And I said, yeah, I don't write books. I just sort of sit down and do my thing in the studio. That's where I want to be. And then COVID happened, and I suddenly found myself with nothing to do. I was sitting here in my cozy little cottage, and my dear manager, Dan Cavanaugh, said, hey, Moish, why don't you write a book? I said, I guess I'm cornered. I have to do it. I never really wanted to be on the live side of the microphone. I always spent my life on the other side of the microphone. Let's go from letter A, you know, and doing stuff like that. So I finally decided to come out from behind the curtain and sit down and write my story. It took 2.5 years. The book is a little under 350 pages. And I got a really good team of people around me who really care about what happened and what we were doing. And I sat down and I suddenly realized that I really was an author, that I could actually write something. It took about, I'd say, a little less than a year to find the right publisher. It was a wonderful bunch of gents in London called Jawbone Press. And they really kind of encouraged me. And I looked at some bigger publishers. But these guys were like genuinely interested in putting their hands all over it, not sort of relegating me to, oh, we're only going to put you in bookstores, we're only going to sell you online or this and that. And they really were eager to work with me and to put things together. And I got a tremendous team. I got this young whippersnapper up in Canada, in Calgary, Jim Riley, who also happens to be a middle school principal, but he's also a first-class musician and a great writer. And once I had the manuscript together, he started helping me work on it, and it turned into a real team effort. And then Pushkin Industries came on board. They wanted to do the audio album. And I spent the entire month of August reading the book from cover to cover. And my dear friend, Gio Bertocelli, who is a really good first-class recording engineer, came on board, and she recorded it all. And the whole thing just turned into a great team of people. And I was really sort of moved along. Anytime I got any resistance at all for myself, they were there to encourage me. Like you, I love the RE20. I see you're using it off-axis, but that's the mic I used with all of Stevie Wonder's vocals. It's one of my very, very favorite microphones. So there you go. But that's what caused me to write the book. I mean, I'm 80, I'll be 85 in August, and here I am, going to the gym 2 or 3 days a week and walking the dogs and staying as fit as I can, and really kind of enjoying it a little bit, although I kind of miss the studio a little bit. But I've always envisioned that when I do pass, I'll be going out the studio door feet first. I'm happily working on this, and I expect to get out on the road a little bit and stir up the thing a little bit. There's some interesting things afoot right now with AI. There's no denying that it exists. You can say AI and data center in the same breath. The big Meshuggahs are up there hobnobbing with the greats, the near greats, and the end greats, building these data centers and sucking up all the fresh water and stuff, and all kinds of things are going on. And the wheels of civilization are grinding on. I think we're at the beginning of something that's very major. It's just not music that's dealing with AI, but I think the entire culture is in a huge change, and I think that music is going to be a very, very important part of how we stay civilized. I do have concerns about it. Somehow Sora, which is, I mean, is so well funded. I mean, I'm just a little fly in the ointment, but I don't know if making music with a vending machine is the real answer to making records, I think. And recordings of art, but it is there. It exists. It's turning our copyright laws inside out, and it lacks the humanity of the athleticism of making music, which is part of what makes music so perfectly imperfect. I think we're going to have to start really looking at that. But sooner or later, someone's going to really figure it out. And it's going to be way beyond the drum machine, and me tweaking the synthesizer one note at a time in 1970. It's been a long road, and I've seen it grow and change and evolve. I'm not entirely sure I buy all of it, but whether I buy it or I don't buy it, I'm not going to be able to say stop. It's going to be a different place, and I don't know how somebody 20 years old sitting at the kitchen table with his laptop and a set of earbuds is that going to change music? Are those the kids that are going to move our civilization forward? Are there new Bob Dylans out there? Are there new Stevie Wonders out there? Are there people who actually have command of an instrument athletically, physically? I don't know. I haven't really been listening to a lot of it. I don't know. Like I say, a lot of it makes me feel like I'm listening to something coming out of a vending machine. I don't know whether you tell it what to do is really considered an artistic endeavor, but I know they're pushing it like crazy and selling millions of things and overwhelming our copyright system. When a guy can sit down and write 25 songs in a week and then send them all into Spotify, what that does to the publishing world. I don't know whether that's, I'm not in the buggy whip business, I guess, But anyway, that's another story for another day.
Music for me is about community. And I'm even seeing this thing about where people kind of want to make these artificial music communities. They're like, how can we make a scene? How can we get this to happen? And, your book is a perfect example of like, you weren't making a scene. It was just there. It was people making their art and those worlds collided. It wasn't something you could manufacture.
Yeah, well, it's a community. When you go into the studio with three or four people to play, there is a degree of equality. There's a degree of resistance where you say, "Oh, well, let's play this on the backbeat." And the guy says, "No, well, maybe we should really have it on the pickup and the dot the third note or whatever. But there is an interchange going on between the musicians. It's not, oh, play this bar, this way, and the thing plays the bar that way. There's no resistance. There's no community of mutuality, of I can't say, it's sort of like a sexual, not physically sexual, but a sort of intimacy that happens between players that work together in a band. It's the reason that, on one reason that the record business is collapsing, basically, with the exception of, some of the super duper people in the upper 5% of the thing. But the thing is, the people who are really making money now are the people who are traveling and playing live. That's really where it is, because we anticipate imperfection, and that's part of the reason why we like to see people play live. They might play the band might be touring and play the same song 25 times in the space of 6 weeks, and every time they play it, it's different. Because of the room, because of the space, because of the attitude, because of how they're feeling, how they're getting along with their spouses, whatever it is that drives their lives forward. And when they step on the stage, it's a fresh time, and people look on it with anticipation. Are they going to make that high note? Are they going to be able to complete that cadenza? How is the cadenza? Bach? Or Mozart piano concertos for two pianos, how they're exchanging energy back and forth. There's the kind of communality in music that is very, very special, and only musicians know it. Only people who see the creativity in the studio or on a stage really understand that energy. Like I say, talking to a computer, although the computer's very nice, the computer only knows how to look backwards because it's trained on the past. How is it going to write jazz? I haven't really heard much about that yet, because it's totally improvised. How do you teach a computer to play that way? We're a long way from Bing Crosby and Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman. The kids don't listen to that music. Maybe we listen to it a little bit because I'm over 80 years old. I'm an antique myself. I don't know what the kids are listening to now that's going to change their worlds. And I don't know, listening to some output from some. And I come from electronic music. I mean, Tonto was a synthesizer, after all. But we weren't synthesizing the compositions, we were synthesizing the sounds. And those sounds didn't happen on stage. They happened in space. They're vibrating electrons. They weren't sounds until they fell out of the loudspeaker. The studio, in that sense, especially with Stevie, the studio itself became a musical instrument that you inhabited. That's a different animal. But if you look at the how music has changed over the last 50 or 60 years, just in the terms of loudness. If you put Glenn Miller in his orchestra, or Spike Jonze and his orchestra in the studio, and they're all honking and playing together and doing their thing, and there are three or four microphones in the stay on the stage there, and if you look at the sound pressure level of that whole band, maybe 65, 70 dB SPL sound pressure level, right? They're putting out about average music, about that level. And the recording environment was very different. The main room was the recording studio. Now the main room is the control room, right? Different thing happening. The music was about 67, maybe 70 dB SPL when it was really loud. And when you take the Red Hot Chili Peppers, you put the Kiss or any of these big bands, or they're really rocking out, making a lot of noise, you're looking at 120 dB SPL. How do you handle that kind of frequency in a recording studio? How do you handle that kind of level? We had to build rooms that could accommodate that acoustically. And the science of recording made leaps ahead. When I started Nixon Records, it was all Armstrong automation, you know, this, right? And now, you know, you just push a button and you wait and it all the, but you only move one fader at a time because it's all serial. I don't know really what that means, but I do know this, that we're children of the medium now. Marshall McLuhan said it, you know, the medium is the message. And how we make that happen to really change people's worlds is what we're really still looking for. I think we did it with Stevie. I think I did it with him. I did it with Billy Preston. I did it with Devo and Whippet because I really understood the medium and how to respect it and how to manipulate it and use it. To really get the artists to perform to the limits of their potential. And that really, what is a producer, a co-producer, associate, whatever you want to call it, that's the job. To get the artists to perform inside the medium to the full limits of their potential and not to color that or change it. I'm such a windbag. It's unbelievable. Anyways, I'm very opinionated.
Well, I mean, on that idea of, you know, using the technology, like I went back and listened to Zero Time last night, and yeah,
Did
you
you have
have
popcorn? Popcorn? What's your name?
I did not.
Oh.
But it's the compositions. It's not that the technology or the instrument is sounding so out there, the compositions are still there. You still were able to convey that sense of beauty and motion in the music.
Right. But there no, it all happened inside vibrating electrons in space. There was no three sweaty guys on the stage, and you're looking at a proscenium march with three guys playing on the stage, and you're there gawking at them eating hot dogs and popcorn, and those guys are sweating away at the there, and they could be you could be high in the balcony, and there's little three little guys on the stage. You know, it wasn't that at all because with Tonto, it was all it was one instrument and two players. And one program, one player affected the other player. It was two people playing the same instrument at the same time. One instrument, like Malcolm would be transitioning chord changes, chords would be changing on one keyboard. And if I played only on the white notes, I could never make a mistake because the keyboard would be transitioning under my hands. We tried to do something where we really were integrated inside a new sound. We really were looking at, with Tonto, we're really looking at taking electronic music on the road. And it was a very, when it was all analog, it was a very different thing. Now we have things called the Eurorack. And the Eurorack is really Junior Tonto Junior, is what we were doing, but we were doing it all analogly. And it was very big and very cumbersome, but we got some marvelous things going because it was, because we could make mistakes, because it was imperfect, is what made it compelling. Had it been all clocked out and you know, synthesized with the drum machine and all that stuff, it wasn't that at all. We never went there. We wanted to ditch all that stuff and come up with some new kind of way to listen to music. And we succeeded. I only wish we'd spent more time doing it. I really do miss Malcolm, I'll tell you. He's gone. He's up there making stardust now. His wife just passed last week. As a matter of fact, my condolences to his family. But Malcolm lived a long and fruitful life. He was an amazing human being. He was the answer man. He had answers for everything when it came to music and technology. What's the conclusion? Technology drives the art. Technology drives the art. I can't say it enough. It's really We are in a new realm beyond acoustic blowing in a pipe or scraping something or strumming something. We're at another place manipulating the medium, but we have to make it humane. And I think that we're still a ways away from most of it. There's certain things that are humane. I mean, like Malcolm and I, Malcolm basically invented the joystick. With electronic music, because we couldn't bend any notes. Like, when you play the guitar, you want to bend something. You're playing the blues and you squeeze the bridge and the fingerboard and you pull the strings and it bends the notes, or you have a bender on the instrument, because bending the sound makes it more humane and imperfect and brings a feeling of stress and relief, certain things in music. And with a keyboard instrument, everything was regular, intervallic between one note and the next note. And Malcolm took it's a side story, but Malcolm took an airplane radio controlled thing from an airplane, model airplane controller. And he fixed it up underneath so that he put rubber bands under there. So if you let go of the stick, it would go back to neutral. And we had little, calibration pots on the thing, and one direction it was in one direction it was pitch this way, and the other direction it was filter. So it became a very expressive tool, and for the first time it really allowed us to bend notes and to change their sonority in real time. It wasn't a secondary layer, but it brought a tremendous amount of musicality to the synthesizer. A very good example of that would be Stevie Wonder's song Boogie on Reggae Woman, which was the first song to use that. Stevie was like jumped in with both feet. There was no stopping him. Once he figured out what the synthesizer could do, he was swimming full speed and he ditched the life preserver. He really got it. He understood it. Malcolm and I could handle the programming and bring what his wishes were and his desires were, but we were there to translate that into the mechanical, electromechanical world, and to urge him on and keep him going and encourage him. He's the most incredible human being. He's not perfect, none of us are, but he is a remarkable recording artist and very connected to the things that are very important, the social issues of our time. I can remember recording Living for the City and how really important that record was. I was very sensitive to it, as was Malcolm, because when I was in high school, I went to a very progressive high school. Arlo Guthrie went to the same school. It was called the Stockbridge School. It was in Massachusetts, virtually across the street of the summer home of the Boston Symphony. And it was in an old, big old mansion. It was 80 students, coeducational, international, and interracial. And this is 19, I graduated from high school in 1956. Where were you in 1956? Indeed, indeed. A mere slip of a lad, I have a feeling. But the school flew the United Nations flag. I know it's a little diversion, but it was the time when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. It was the time when John Lewis was walking on the Norman Pettit Bridge. It was the time when what's her name was sitting in the back of the bus, wouldn't sit in the back of the bus. It was the time when little black girls were being escorted to school by armed marshals, federal marshals. And we really followed a lot of that because the school was very connected to UNESCO and to the United Nations. And Hans, who is the headmaster, traveled all over the place. And our student body was co-ed, international, and interracial. We called all the teachers by their first names. We followed the civil rights movement very closely. We traveled as an interracial group and had to sleep in a church a couple nights on the pews because we refused to be desegregated. So when Stevie came along and I heard what he was doing, I knew that this was something that is more major in many ways that you would think of just being a songwriter. Another one would be another songwriter like that that came out of black music was Marvin Gaye. What's going on? All right. But Steve was writing, Malcolm and I would be get very excited because we would really encourage Steve to write as powerfully as he could about race relations, about segregation, and about what was going on down south. It was an interesting song because it was that time when a lot of young black kids were either moving, trying to get out of the south. And they were either going up to Detroit to work in the car factories or come to New York. So that narrative was like a little movie in your head. And we were very encouraged by that. And I think it's possibly one of the most important songs I've ever recorded and had the privilege of being a part of. But Steve was doing stuff like that, or You Haven't Done Nothing, Richard Nixon. Steve always was stood up for the underdog. Steve really understood it. I only wish he was 40 years younger. In my mind's eye, he's still 21 years old, you know. Those 3 or 4 years we worked together were magical and beautiful. And we were very enabled by the situation. Of course, we didn't really take care of business the right way or anything. Who cared? I didn't give a fuck about it. This contract and that contract, and do this and do that, and credits and all kinds of things. We didn't care. There's only one thing that was important to me, that was making music. I figured everything else would take care of itself. Well, here I am, 84 and a half years old, and somehow it's all taken care of itself. So now, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, you said it in there. I think about Boogie On Reggae Woman. This is one of my favorite pieces of music, and that sound on there to me is like so human, and that idea, that innovation that's in that tune. And it must have just been electric to be around somebody who was that creative. All three of you, just being creative and having it bounce around the room like that.
Yeah, well, you don't think about it when you're doing it. It's like sex. You don't think about what your next move is going to be when you're rolling around in the bed. Things just happen. And that's the way it was in the studio. Not having sex in the studio, but having an open space where Steve would come up with something, we'd take it and run with it. We'd come up with something and Steve would run with it. It was an open table. There was nobody else. We were doing Music in My Mind in the early records when, Steve really wasn't sort of in the forefront of the highlight of everything. And he was on his own. He was out of the Motown deal and stuff. And he was just working on his own thing. We didn't have to worry about budget or anything. We didn't have to worry where our next slice of cake was going to come from. We just worked, Sometimes we'd When we're at the record plant, we'd work for 2 or 3 days at a time and come out blinking in the sunshine one morning at 6:30 in the morning with our hands in our pockets and a joint in our mouth. Steve never went to that place, never smoked weed. I never saw him ever get high on anything, alcohol or anything. It's all in his head. I don't know. I think that scar on his head, right there, the scar. I think that God touched him there or something. I think some hand came down and put his finger on Steve's head and zapped him with the talent that he has. I don't have an answer for it. All I know is that there's certain people you work with that are just that have that blessing. Another person who had that blessing I worked with and I really loved was Billy Preston, who's got a really interesting, there's a really interesting movie about his life. Keyboard player who really came out of the church very conflicted. And where can you get a guy who plays with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles at the same time? What is that about? Okay. You know, life has been, as I say, life is tragic, life is magic. Or life is magic, life is tragic. You could take it either way. But you know, you live your life a day at a time and you try to do the best you can. And what's your job? To get an artist to perform to the limits of his potential every single time. It's not about you, it's about them. And as soon as you stop figuring and thinking about yourself and thinking about them is when success happens. And that's the truth, lad.
I wanted to ask you about what I thought was one of the more interesting, or I should say unexpected entries in your work as a producer, which was working with Tony McAlpine. How did that occur, that the two of you got together?
Well, Tony is a very interesting artist. Again, very driven, very talented. And it was a time where I was no longer working with Malcolm. I was working with a young scallywag named Brant Biles. And Brant was a guitar thrasher like Tony, and Brant really understood guitar players in much way more than me in many ways, because he was in a band, and he could get out there and really just burn like a, you know, like crazy, and you know, had his guitar heroes and stuff, and had tremendous sensibility for guitar players. But what we did with Tony is what we did with Stevie and also with Billy, is we used quad monitoring in the control room, and when Tony was in the control room, we used quads so that Tony occupied the same space as the music. The music wasn't here, and the listener was there, or the player was here, and there's this imaginary proscenium arch here, and there are these three little guys down, way down there, playing their hearts out with a lot of echo and reverb and stuff. I've always been much more intimate and close, like that RE20 you're talking into. That was a mic Stevie loved to use, and I've used for 40 or 50 years. You could touch it, and it doesn't give any off any handling noise of touching, so Steve could know where he was. But Tony, we worked with Tony in the control room, and we, you know, put three or four different stacks in the studio. And we mic'd them all differently so that we could combine them in the room. And Tony just was blazing. He's super talented. And Brant really understood where that was coming from. And I learned a tremendous amount. I learn it every time I go into the studio with an artist. Everyone is unique and different. The ones that try to sound like someone else, they're a dime a dozen. But the guys who don't think about stuff like that, like Tony McAlpine, the ones who actually break the ice first, those are the ones that are really the true geniuses. Tony, that record was amazing and very underrated record too, I might add. One of my favorites. Another one of my favorites is the Odd Get Even with Shadowfax, which was a major record for me. It was one of the first records to use spatial processing. Those guys are super gifted guys too. We're writing some really beautiful stuff. The first album I recorded in digital for Warner Brothers. So David Sanborn, another one, gifted and unusual in their work. And now I'm talking to Michael Cimbello about Michael was in Wonderlove with Steve. And we're talking about doing some more music together. The old codger band. Who knows what's going to happen? But you know, the blues is the blues, you know. You can be any age to play the blues. And a good solid live recording of that would be, I would like that very much. Yeah, Tony was a gift, a real gift. He was very talented man. And here we are, the other end of the rainbow. What's next?
I mean, that's interesting because I guess if I start really thinking about the discography, I would say the majority of the people that you worked with are those kind of I guess you would call them one-offs, where it's like they're not pantomiming somebody else's stuff. It's like they've got their distinct vision. That has to be very attractive, you know?
Well, yes. You want to talk about a distinct vision as political overtones? Let's talk about Devo, Kent State. That's where the band found its real reason to be. Mark and Jerry were students at Kent State when the National Guard came down and murdered a bunch of students in the commons. And it really began to understand the real meaning of devolution. I really got behind them. As a matter of fact, Mark Mothersbaugh wrote the foreword to my book. We've been dear friends for 50 years. I can't say we're particularly, you know, go dining two or three nights a week and hanging out and stuff. But we have deep friendship and mutual respect. And the reason that record really succeeded, again, we recorded, we tracked it in quad in the control room. So the guys in the band didn't have to look down at themselves as a little object on the stage, but they lived in the same space as the music. It's one guitar over here, a synthesizer over there, the drums were over here, the background vocals were back there, and so forth. And loud, loud and clean. The real trick with Devo was not to try to impose a producer's signature sound like Jack Antonoff, right? You know a Jack Antonoff record when you hear it because he has his way, or a Bob Clearwater mix. You hear it because you hear their style on the project. My real goal was not to do that. My real goal was to sound like I want the band to sound like the band, not about me putting waterfalls and string parts and stuff all over everything, but to try to get the succinct shape of the music as it came out of them together. And when you do that, then you have success. Is the record steady? Is it, if you take, even this was Steve too, if you take 8 bars or 16 bars of any of that music and you tell me if two or three of the bars are at the same tempo exactly, they're not. When they're going to a verse or a chorus, there's maybe a little bit of speeding up or slowing down. There's dynamics inside the mix. If you think of Boogie on Reggae Woman, you listen just to the clavinet parts, for example, you'll see that there are places where the delays are clashing because that funkiness is a good thing. The randomness is what makes the unpredictability of that kind of performance is what makes it interesting. You know, like it's, you know, one day I was sitting in my car. It was in August. It was very hot. And I was in a parking lot waiting to go into a studio. And there's this big wall of green plants in front of the window, right, like that. And I was looking at it for like 10 minutes because there was nobody around. And I didn't have the keys to go into the studio. And what happened was I was watching that and saying something. Nothing was happening, totally still. And then a bird flew through the scene. My attention went right to the bird, and I followed the bird like this. The bird sped up and slowed down and stuff, but I was watching the bird, right? That's like watching the end of the stick of Leonard Bernstein conducting the orchestra and speeding up and slowing down. You watch what's in motion that's unpredictable. That's what separates the men from the boys. You could see that in anything from the Busboys to Tony McAlpine to Devo to Stevie to Billy, that there is a degree of what I call beautiful unpredictability, that they own that music. And the job of the producer is to let them own it and to let them perform to the limits of their potential and not let anything stand in the way of that. And that's really been the story of all of my work. Mixing in quad, that was a huge discovery because how does your brain know where a sound is coming from? You ever think about that? When a sound comes from behind you, is it a threat in our primal past where we don't know if there's a predator behind you, you hear footsteps behind you? It conveys a different kind of energy than something you hear in front of you that you can attach to your eyeballs to confirm what you're hearing. And when sound is in motion, it's a beautiful thing when it's in motion. You know, it's, I don't know. I think the motion is maybe as important as any of the other elements in a recording. And where the sound comes from, it's not a report of reality anymore. You know, when we, the quad, what happened was when we came out from New York with Steve, Gary Kellgren and Chris Stone were had the record plant, which was a psychedelic adventure par excellence. You could lock yourself in there for a week. You had these rooms where you could stay and hang out. And then you could work in the studio and order in from Cantor's and have a pastrami sandwich and some coleslaw and Dr. Brown's cream soda. And you could work there. You could jump into the jacuzzi if you were tired. It was really the first residential hotel and studio. But you could go in there, like the Hotel California, that song from the Eagles. That's the song that's about the record plant. That's where the guy, the Eagles, got their inspiration. But you could go in there, and what happened was it was during a time when quadraphonic was becoming a big deal for a second. And the Brits were really behind it. Decca was behind it in England and London, and RCA over there were doing a lot of classical music in it. And Sansui came up with a device called QS, I think it was called, which was claimed to be able to put true quad in vinyl. It really didn't work all that well. There were certain things you could do with it, but the real separation really wasn't there. But we mixed some stuff in quad, including Superstition. It sounded terrific in quad, but it didn't sound so terrific in the vinyl because there was not really the separation. And who was going to ask everyone to buy two amplifiers so that you could have quad speakers with the discrete amplifiers in all the corners? It became very expensive and very ponderous because everything was big. We didn't have the kind of miniaturization we have now, or the ability to have spatialization and earphones and stuff. And it wasn't successful. It folded after a while, although there's some collectors today who still really treasure those quad records. But what it brought to me and to Malcolm Cecil and Steve was the fact that we had a quad control room. We built a quad control room, and we had quad buses on the API console. So it became a recording tool where I could put the sound around Steve or around the Devos or who was ever working in the control room to be able to place them inside the song. It had nothing to do anymore with the report of reality. And that was true with Billy. That was true with Devo, which we recorded a lot of it in quad like that, not to release it in quad, but to use the quad as a tool of recording, as a way of manipulating the sound to be able to hear it, because it's not acoustic. A lot of the sounds that come through it are all electronic sounds, already all electricity. There is, you know, if there's an acoustic instrument you're putting in there, put the acoustic instrument like the drums in the studio, but he's looking into the glass, and inside the control room are four other players. And all of a sudden, the recordings engineers, the console, the speakers, all the musicians, all the headphones, all no headphones in the control room, and loud, 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 and really in touch with the sound. It has nothing to do with the report of reality. It's not the New York Philharmonic, you know, with the guy doing this, right? There's something very visceral happening. And the real trick is to get that and to preserve it. And that's what I've been doing for 80 years, or whatever, 70, I guess. So, what have you been doing? What about you?
You've been listening to a conversation with Robert Margalef. His new book, Shaping Sounds, Stevie Wonder, Devo, The Synth Revolution, and My Life Behind the Music, is out May 19th via Jawbone Press. You can learn more about him and his rich history via his official website, robertmargaleff.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.